All right, so we're doing Hilchos Tshuva, and the Rambam, in the heading, the listing of the mitzvahs, says that there is one mitzvah. It's a mitzvah aseh, and as we mentioned yesterday, there's a bit of a ambiguity in the language. He said, describing the mitzvah very succinctly, "V'hu sheyoshuv hachote mecheto lifnei Hashem yizvadeh." And that is that the sinner should return from his sin lifnei Hashem, before God. So we found that to be a little bit of a problem, because why is he invoking the idea of before God? So if you just read the wording, the lifnei Hashem, it modifies something. It could modify the term yoshuv, the verb, to return. So that is the question. Is the Rambam saying that the return has to be before God? Or it could also modify mecheto, or is it a reference to the sin? That is to say that he has to return from the sin which was before God. Those are the two logical possibilities. And then it says v'yizvada, and he should confess. So, we raise the question as far as that's concerned. The Rambam is prescribing two things. One is tshuva, and one is vidui. So what exactly is the mitzvah? Or are they two components of the mitzvah? And if they're two components, what's the relationship between the two? Must you have both? Can you have one without the other? And so on and so forth. And so those are some of the basic questions that we raise. So we're going to proceed now to the first halach in the Rambam. He says, "Kol mitzvos sheba Torah, all the mitzvos of the Torah, bein asei, bein lo sase, whether they be a asei or whether they be a lo sase, whether they be positive or negative commands." Now, bear in mind that as everything unfolds over here, it would seem that each point that the Rambam is making has to be made. That is to say that there is some kind of a chiddush over here. And the Rambam's point, as we'll see, is he's saying that the tshuva is required for a violation of all the mitzvahs. He could have simply said, whenever a person sins, he has to do tshuva. He's very specific, though. He says, "Kol mitzvos, sheba Torah, whether they be positive or whether they be negative. Im avar adam alachas mehen, if a person violated any one of them, bein bezadon, bein bishkaga, whether intentionally, willfully, or bishkaga. Shkaga means an error. It doesn't mean accidentally. What is the difference between shogeg and ones? And of course the question does arise, what about ones? What if a person violated by accident, by ones? What would be the case? The Rambam didn't mention if a person sins ba'ones, by accident, where he really, either he had no control over the situation, or for example, a person can buy a kosher product, and it happens from time to time that mistakes are made. You know, they always have these announcements in the paper that this particular product has the kosher label, but we're recalling it. So therefore, whoever has it should get rid of it. You know, what about people who ate it already? Do they have to do tshuva for the fact that they ate unkosher food? So, offhand, we would say no, because they didn't commit a sin. They were acting in accordance with the halachic procedure, assuming that everything was checked out, assuming that it's reliable. So then, something occurred outside of their control. I know this might be horrifying to a person to imagine that, but to say a person, this is a different type of an ones, by the way, because here the person knew what he was doing, intentionally ate the food, but with complete knowledge in his framework that it was actually kosher. But the truth of the matter is he ate trick. So what is a person supposed to do about a situation like that? I'm just mentioning that if a person should eat something which is treif, but absolutely was beyond his control. He had no way of knowing, and he used all the correct mechanisms of halacha to ascertain that it was kosher. In spite of all that, the accidents happened. So if a person should discover that he just ate something like that, the idea that he has to try and force himself to regurgitate or anything along those lines, and most people would probably feel miserable about it, is based on the idea that the reason behind kosher is because there's something inheres in the quality of the food itself, that it has a certain, it damages you in a certain way. I know that's a very popular and widespread belief, but we've discussed it many times. It's very, very difficult to maintain that position. There's many, many cases where you see that a person is permitted to eat these things. There's this concept of bittul berov. That is true. That if you have three pieces of meat and they're all the same, and one tray from two are kosher, so according to the basic halacha, you can eat all of them. Bittul berov. During wartime, it's permitted. The Rambam says at the time of kibush. At the time of kibush, a number of things are permitted. One of those things would be that a person's permitted to eat tray foods, but there's a condition if it's a bit difficult. He doesn't say it's a matter of sakana. And he doesn't say it's a matter of a danger to the war effort, because it's really after the war is concluded. It's at the time of the victory, the siege. If it's difficult to obtain kosher, so the Torah was matir. The Torah removed the restriction, and he actually refers to arpei chazirim. It's because it says you'll find houses filled with all of good things, Malayim kol tov, good things. So the Gemara says that's a reference to arpei chazirim, the necks of pigs. So the Torah is calling it a good thing. That's the basic idea, that the Torah didn't prohibit it because there's anything inherently evil about it. It's a system that God has established within which a person is supposed to maintain restraints over his instinctual nature and to redirect his energies in a certain path. So the essence of the chait, consists in the fact that he's disobedient to the system of God, to the will of God, and indulges himself in that which God has prohibited. But if that is the case, that a person acted in accordance with the will of God, and it happens that quite by accident that the food in question was treif, so then he didn't do any sin, and he doesn't have to feel bad about the situation. You see that there's nothing inherent in the food, because in those cases where the Torah said one can partake of them, so one partakes of them, because in that case you're in line with the will of God. It's always, you say, you shouldn't attach something to a particular, to attribute characteristics to physical things. It all has to do with obedience to the will of God. All right, so the Rambam over here is leaving out the category of ones, which makes sense, because we're talking about tshuva. And what is the primary condition which demands tshuva? Has to be sin. It has to be avera. The difference between ones and shogeg is, what's shogeg then? Shogeg is where a person did the action in error, made a mistake. So that's a different case. In the first case, in the case of ones, he really did not do that action. From the standpoint of human behavior, you can't refer to it as an action. As Matt mentioned before, if a person on Shabbos leans back accidentally and in the course of doing so flicks on the light, you can't say he performed an act of putting on the light. That's not a human action, because it didn't have any intention. However, in shogeg, there was an action, that the person had intention to do this particular deed. It's lacking in willfulness. It's lacking in rebelliousness. There was no intention to rebel, but it was done in ignorance. So this is a big chiddush over here. Because a person can raise the question, so why does he have to do tshuva? Isn't tshuva sin? And doesn't sin presuppose a certain attitude of negation of the command of God? So where does that exist over here? If you ask a person, the average individual, as to whether or not there should be a concept of tshuva with regard to shogeg, which is error, I think that from a purely logical standpoint, the person would have a right to say that no, there's no requirement of tshuva, because where was sin? That's not sin. Sin presupposes knowledge. I have to know that there's a law. And once I know that there's a law, so now you can fault me. I flaunted the law. But if I didn't know that there was a law, where was the sin? So what's the redress? What should be the redress in this case? Learn more. So it makes sense to me to differentiate between different types of ones. There are certain activities which a person does because he has certain instinctive behaviors. You could even call it a compulsive behavior, instinctive behavior. Like on Shabbos, for example, sometimes a person is simply in the habit of flicking a switch as he leaves the bathroom. And then he's shocked and he realizes he did something wrong. So that would not be on the level of shogeg, which would require a karbon. Because a true shogeg is a case where the person did the action knowingly, willfully, with a mistaken notion. He completely forgot that it's Shabbos. Here this person didn't completely forget that it's Shabbos at all. He knows that it's Shabbos. It's just an instinctive kind of a behavior. It's very close to being what we call misaseg, that if a person is preoccupied in doing one thing, and in the course of doing that he accidentally does something which was prohibited, so there's no intention for the prohibited. Or as I gave an example, if a person is walking down the street, and this person always likes to pluck leaves, let us say, it's a habit that he has, from hedges or from bushes, and he's involved in a discussion, he knows that it's Shabbos. In fact, he's talking about Hilchos Shabbos. As a result, but while he's engaged in that discussion, he walks by and he plucks a leaf, and then he realizes that he did the wrong thing. That would not be a true shogeg. It would fall into the category then of ones, but I would maintain that it's different than the other case of ones that we mentioned before. The case we mentioned before is a case where, for example, if a person bought a kosher product, and due to accidental circumstances, it was unkosher. So there's no negligence on his part. There's no intention to eat unkosher on his part. So there's no relationship between any culpability on his part and what took place, the action, the avera. That's not the case, however, in the example of Shabbos that we gave, where it's true that the activity resulted from a certain type of a compulsion, a mindlessness, and you see that an avera has to have a certain element of intention, that the mind has to be involved in the action in order to render it into an action. However, there is a causal relationship between the intention of the person and what transpires. That is to say, the person did intend to pull a leaf. It's just the reason behind it is not because he forgot that it's Shabbos. It's because of some other factor. So I would say that in this situation, the person would be required to do tshuva. Now, before we explain that, let's tie this in to the first question that we raised. The first question that we raised was, so in general, why does a person have to do tshuva for shogeg altogether? Since we said that in shogeg, he did not have any desire to thwart the will of God. Yeah, basically the idea of shogeg, first of all, we see that the Torah does not regard it as being purely an accident. It's a no-fault type of a thing. Most people have that idea. Well, I didn't know. The Torah maintains that the error, that when a person makes an error, it reflects upon his entire attitude towards the significance of the thing itself. That's the basic idea. You can study the areas in which a person is prone to make errors. In our own daily lives, in our own situations, when you're dealing with other people, for example, if someone is working for you, or someone's supposed to be helping you, and he's careless about what he's doing, and it causes you a loss, some kind of a damage or a loss, and you complain, you say, well, I didn't know. You get upset with the person. People have a ambivalent attitude with regard to this whole issue of errors, or mistakes. Let's call it mistakes. It's based upon who made the mistake. If you made the mistake, so then you protest, it was a mistake. How am I had no bad intention. How am I supposed to know? If somebody else made a mistake that caused you a loss, then you get angry. When you made a mistake, how can you make a mistake? So you see that the attitude shifts. It all depends upon who made the mistake. But if you made the mistake, so then you, well, what are you getting angry at me for? I had no intention. It was just a mistake. You see how people's attitude changes. So what is the truth? the truth is that it is a reflection of the values of the individual. In an area where the person regards it as being important, he doesn't make mistakes, he eliminates mistakes. That's his obligation. For example, when it comes to an illness and medication, if a person has a significant condition and he has to follow a certain regimen of the doctor, he makes it a point to know it and to follow it, and he doesn't make mistakes. And therefore, when a person does make mistakes in a consistent kind of a way, it really reflects his whole underlying attitude. It means the whole thing is not that important to him. That's the idea of shogeg. And it's not the same as mazed. The Torah is not equating the two. Obviously, a person does an avera b'mazed with willfulness, so the penalty, the punishments are more serious on him, on every level. If he did it b'shogeg, so then the Torah prescribes a karbon. It's not as serious. He's not liable to the serious penalties. The Torah is not saying it's the same thing. But with regard to tshuva, which is basically the idea of tshuva is, as we'll soon see, to reinstate a person's relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to repair the damage that was done in terms of a person's relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what tshuva is all about. So then, that's a breach. A person did an avera b'shogeg, so that's a serious breach. Because if he would have recognized how significant it is and how important it is, if he would have paid the same attention to it as he would to what his doctor tells him to do, so then he wouldn't commit an avera b'shogeg. Well, I mean, that's not to say that that's a separate point. Nobody's perfect. Nobody is perfect. And we're not saying that if the person were had the right attitude, he would never sin. That's a different idea. That we're weak, that's human nature, and a person is bound to sin. That's something else. But it's sin. And sin requires tshuva. So that's why, if a person sinned b'shogeg, so that's an avera, that's a maisa avera. And it's a defect in his entire relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he can't just walk away from it. It requires repair, because that's a significant element in the relationship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then the person has to work on that. The Havmin of the Rambam would be that only when the defect reaches the level where it expresses itself in a willful rebelliousness, you would think that that's, it's a different degree, obviously, in terms of a person's distance from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you might think that it's true that if a person did something b'shogeg, so it's a negative, but it doesn't require tshuva. It doesn't require the introspection of tshuva. That's what you might think. But only that case where it manifested itself in a overt action, which we call mazed. But the chiddush of the Rambam is that anything which constitutes a ma'is avera, anything which constitutes a violation, is a serious breakdown in the way a person is supposed to organize his life. Now, if you apply that principle from a philosophical standpoint, then it can turn out that even though something doesn't qualify as a ma'isa avera due to technicalities, the cases we've been talking about, where a person was, so to speak, misasek, and walking down the street on Shabbos, and he's always, habitually, he'll pull out a leaf, and he did that. So even if it doesn't qualify technically as being shogeg, but according to the principle that we've enunciated, that the activity does reflect a defect. If it reflects a defect in terms of his relationship to the system of mitzvos to Shabbos, which it does, because a person should know about this. That is to say, before Shabbos begins, a person should enter with the proper attitude and everything should really be prepared. So if a person really was concerned to keep Shabbos on every level and not to be involved in any kind of malacha, so he would guard himself against those particular weaknesses that he has. And that's why people put on those Shabbos covers, the covers for the lights. Even though it's protecting you against something which would be an accident, perhaps, nevertheless, a person knows their own nature and does whatever they could possibly do to see to it that they won't come to the avera. So that's the reason why I'm saying that on Shabbos, a person, it's different. Even if something which was done in a manner which was accidental and which didn't constitute shogeg, still, if it's something which has to do with his nature, and he's aware of that part of his nature, and he doesn't do anything to change it, then that itself is a reflection of his disregard for the significance of Shabbos. And that's why I'm saying, from a philosophical standpoint, the person should have to do tshuva for that. Those accidents that occur and can no way, shape, or form be attributed to anything that you could have been aware of, or you could have any kind of defect within yourself. You move your chair back and it accidentally knocks something and the performs a malach, puts a light on or something like that. Assuming that there was absolutely no relationship to any behavior on your part that is responsible. But in the other case, there is a behavior on your part. That is, you do like to pull out these leaves. That's part of your nature. You should be aware of your nature, and therefore you should know that on Shabbos it's very possible, very feasible, that it will manifest itself, and you still didn't do anything to prevent it. That would point to a certain defect in your nature. That's a different type of an onus. But still, from a technical standpoint, due to the way the halacha is structured, it may not be defined as what we would call a shogeg, because shogeg too has to have a certain kind of a formula and a definition. To summarize, what the Rambam is talking about is that tshuva is something which has to be done with regard to avera. Later on, in Perek Zayin, the Rambam talks about a different type of a tshuva. Question arises, does a person have to do tshuva only for particular sins? Or what about for what we would call bad characteristics that he had, bad behaviors, defects in his character, and that type of thing? Pursuit of the fact that the person is involved in the wrong values, or violations of what we would call kedoshim to you, that you should be holy. The Rambam talks about that later on. So it's important to be aware of that. Because the Rambam emphasizes that that type of tshuva is even more complicated. The defects in a person's personality which do not necessarily fall into the heading of any particular kind of a mitzvah. But nevertheless, a person has to work on his personality. Anger. A person has a bad temper. Anger is a very serious, not avera, but it is an avera, if you know what I'm talking about. So that's a different kind of a phenomenon. Here the Rambam is talking about the tshuva, which is part of the system of Torah. So God gave us a system, and mitzvos, commands, positive, negative, different categories of violation. Shogeg is a category of violation, and the Rambam here is talking about the tshuva that one must do because of a failure to maintain the system. So therefore, here we're talking just about those things which constitute a mitzvah. The Chiddush in terms of asei and los asei, again, you have to ask yourself, which one would you think would be more of a candidate for tshuva, more of a requirement for tshuva? So the Chiddush seems to be asays. That's a los asei. A los asei, of course, requires a tshuva. But the Rambam is telling you, even your bein asay, asay as well. Meaning you might have thought that if a person violated an asay, that he wouldn't do tshuva, wouldn't have to do tshuva. What's the reasoning behind that? The have meaning would be, because along with this line, that a person has to do tshuva because of a defect in terms of his relationship to God as manifested in God's system. So therefore you have to recognize that there's a difference. In terms of a lo sase, because that's a specific action where you're committing an action definitively in violation. The violation of an ase, there's no action involved. It's a failure. It's a passivity. You didn't fulfill your responsibility. So that's the chiddush. That it is not, you would think that the tshuva is required only when this defect, this rebelliousness, whatever you want to call it, manifests itself in terms of an act which is prohibited, a prohibited action. But where there's no prohibited action, and it's just a result of passivity or inaction, there's the bittul, there's the negation, so then perhaps it doesn't require tshuva. Even though it's a sin, obviously it's sin, but it's a different kind of a sin. So therefore, the Rambam is finished to tell you that that's the category. The category is not the Maisa Avera that's the Machayev, But the bittul, the negation of God's command, if it's the negation, then it doesn't matter how it came about. Whether it came about through action, whether it came about from inaction, that the negation per se, yeah. The negation of the mitzvah is the machayev of tshuva. But again, you see that that point had to be made because one could argue that insofar as tshuva is concerned. And this is not to say that the los assays are more important than the assays. That's a different framework. Assays, are very, very important. Let's, for the time being, just as important as los assays, perhaps even more important, or chashim, so to speak. But that's not the point. I mean, to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ahavas Hashem, they're all positives. So when we're not making that point over here, when it's not a question as to which is more important, that's nothing to do with that issue. But it has to do with the issue of tshuva. That the bittul mitzvah in an assay comes about in a different manner. It doesn't express, there's no particular action which expresses a certain intention, a certain arrogance vis-a-vis God's system. So it's just inaction. Now that's serious, no question about it, and that inaction produces a bittul, a negation of a positive command. But the question is that sufficient to require tshuva? And that's the chiddush, that it does. Yes, it does. Because that is the mechayev of tshuva, it is the bittul of the mitzvah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether it came back through action or through inaction.
The situation to correct. entire structure of the electricity. So that would require a tshuva, in my opinion. Even though it doesn't reach the level of what we call a matzah there. So therefore, okay, this leads to the question. One can raise a question on this. If that's true, so why did Rambam say that any mitzvah of the Torah, whether it's positive, whether it's negative, whether it's intentional, whether it's judged, if he violates any one of them has to do too, but thereby leaving the logical deduction, the conclusion that it's not, if it's an honest one, doesn't have to do so. According to what I'm saying, then one can raise the question, seeing that Rambam had not room for that deduction. He said, in other cases, or whatever, however he chose to explain it, but couldn't you make the case that by stating it this way, that Rambam got a grapple? I believe the answer to the question is in the time of Parish V. You've got to write down Parish V of Uncle Tula, chapter 7. We go to our local dinner. And the Rambam says, Al Toma, the only Tuba, Elamei Avero, the Yishtahen Maasa. He does not say that there's no Tuba except that a Tuba applies only to those Averos that involve an act. Tudon, Jus, the Gezel, the Geneva, for example. And sexual things, or theft, regularly soaked and so forth. That is to say, he's talking over here about Avera. I think that it would include the entire category of this one, because in the first paragraph he said that even when he's talking about it, in terms of Avera, actually, in terms of knowing this one, if I like to this one, he made clear that it wasn't going to but just like the person has to return to the Kafi Sarah for Kafi, the Gaos Rose, the Yisrael. So too, you have to investigate the bad characteristics of this leader, their behavior. The Russians and to return Minhaka, from anger, Minhaka from contentiousness, Minhaka from envy, Minhaka from frivolousness, Minhaka from Amon, from running after money. Very interesting. He's making things that some of them seem more serious than others. They're running after money. I mean, no one would assume that that person is a sinner. The person, what does that mean? What is the person who's running after money? What are you talking about over here? They're only talking about over here. Might be an individual who wants people to solve. The person who's a solo of the community. The person who has an honor to affect as many companies. This will be on the calendar pretty soon, you know, and when the various issues go to things out, people to have their dinners and awards, they're giving the awards too. Alright, there's a certain amount of people that are awarded for their righteousness and other types of things, but let's face it, you have to give the people with the money. People are giving charity. That's a good thing. It's true. You have to all charge the bell. You have to recognize people. Whatever the motivation might be, even if they're doing it for the sake of the honor. That's not the point, but I'm sure, I'm not disparaging anyone, I'm sure that many of these people, the reason why they're in a position where they're able to give all this money, because they require so much money, is what motivates them. People don't acquire huge sums of money unless they have a very strong motivation to pursue large sums of money. Now, there may be many motivations. Many reasons why they're motivated to pursue the acquisition of wealth. So I think that it's a fair conclusion that wealthy people do not wealth, they don't say inherit it. The people that don't inherit it work very, very hard, day and night, and use their skills. And I'm assuming that they're completely yes for now. I'm not I'm not saying that you don't engage in shady behavior. You don't engage in deceitful or illegal. I'm not saying that at all. These are people that know that the society is a gospel and honor. And if they achieve a large money, they have a desire to help institutions and so forth. So my question is, this is what I'm discussing there. Because I already said that all of this wonderful activity that you just described, these people are being honored and extolled, and also they're part of the story when they tell individual and biographical and background about how this person works and came from nowhere and what they built it up and became one of the wealthiest people and built up all the great empires. So my question is that what we're going to talk to you about. I have to understand what he's saying. He's not ghetto. He's prison ghetto. Don't think that it's ghetto. This individual acquired the money through any illegal type of means because he's contracting. He's saying, don't think that you do too much simply because of ghetto, but you need to say even if there was no ghetto. So therefore, one is justified to say that this person acquired legitimately. Because he didn't acquire legitimately, so why is he, then his crime is not legitimate, that's not wrong, his crime is death. Or whatever else, or deception, or lying, whatever else he did. He's saying, no. Yeah, we know you have to achieve a crime. There's another error. But even activities are completely done in a completely legal manner. So if that's the case, what's he doing achievable?
It's a very big kiddish in the Rambam. The Rambam has a section, and it's a good one. So the idea that the Torah is involved in more than just particularity, specific mitzvahs, positive command, negative command, and so on and so forth, but that it's a system of perfection. It's not merely a system of perfection in terms of philosophy, two ideas, it's the whole foundation of the Torah, but that the actual personality, the character of the individual, the character trait, so to speak, that a person has to work on his energy and to direct himself in a certain manner. That's just part of the mitzvah of the halakha b'bracha, that a person has to walk in the way that he's going. And that is to say, the Rambam explains that with regard to all of the various dispositions of the person, with regard to all of the various drives of the person, he really has to direct himself towards what he calls the derech ha'emtzei, towards the medium ground, so to speak, the shpil hazor. And that he can't allow himself to go off towards either extreme, and then he has certain exceptional cases with regard to anger, for example, with regard to ego, he has to be exceedingly humble, and so on and so forth. But that is a command, that's a mitzvah. It's a different type of a mitzvah. It has to do with a certain type of perfection, and that also is subsumed in the heading of tshuva. That is what I'm saying. Don't think that if a person simply refrains from committing any avodah, and the person does all the mitzvahs, the positive thing, so that he's not no leader as far as the particulars of the system are concerned, but in terms of his derech ha'chayim, in terms of his emotional disposition, he's completely out of line with the hashkafa of the Torah. Of course, that requires it. That would be a phenomenal investigation to you. That mere adherence to the system of mitzvot, to say technical adherence to the system of mitzvot, doesn't necessarily mean that a person is perfected. There's a whole arena which can't be legislated in terms of particular mitzvot. And a person can be removed from Shisha Torah, that a person can be completely involved in hedonism, in the pursuit of tigers and so on and so forth, but do it in a manner which is kosher, which is form. So that, over here he's talking about the objective of Torah Torah Kula, which is just, while after the Gotham, walk in the ways of God, that's the particular formulation over here. But that expressing the idea of the Goshen Kula. That it would be absurd for a person to imagine that all we're concerned about in terms of tshuva is with regard to the particulars of the halakhic system, the specific mitzvahs. That's true, that's very important, that's the starting point, that's the foundation. But what if an individual is in conformity in terms of the halachic system, in terms of particular mitzvahs, but in terms of his whole derech ha'chayim, in terms of the whole structure of his method, not just derech ha'chayim, derech ha'chayim, of course, important, but talking about structure, here it's more specific, because you're talking about particular meaning. The person allows himself to develop temper, or the person allows himself to develop ego, or the way he's living his life. This is very, very interesting. He's pursuing honor, or he's pursuing money. He has to even know, seems to be more innocuous. The same way, he's working very hard, very hard. And he's doing it in an honest, ethical way. But that means to say that in terms of the perfection of the soul, in terms of the recognition of the good, all his enemies are directed towards something which is false, which is not the good. That has to do with tshuva. The whole idea of tshuva is the word tshuva itself, to return to what that is. To return to what that is valuable has to be in the framework of a recognition of the good, of the ultimate good. So that's what the Rambam is saying, that would be a big mistake for a person to make, is to say that Torah is only concerned about whether I violated this particular law or the other law. But the person's entire derech ha'chayim and the structure of his emotional disposition is to say that the Torah is not concerned about that, and that has nothing to do with the phenomenon of tshuva. It's absurd that the whole idea of tshuva would be removed. But the whole idea of tshuva is to return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that doesn't include Kadosh Yehiyahu, it doesn't include the halacha of the bracha, because the whole purpose of the Torah is for a person to move in such a way that he gets to recognize the true value of the ultimate good, and get closer and closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So of course, mitzvahs, if he doesn't keep the system that God established, that's rebellion. That's open and direct rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's it. The first thing a person has to do, of course, is to see where he's going to come to the actual system, the halakhic system. That comes first. And that itself is not the highest perfection, as we've seen, that a person, there are many people that could be religiously observant, but in terms of their derech ha'chayim, in terms of what they're striving for, or what's the purpose of being in the past. People have this dichotomy. Unfortunately, if they view the mitzvahs as being religious requirements, like religious observances, ceremonial observances, that's something we've assimilated, so to absorb from the negative. But to negate the element of the perfection of the personality that's involved in the mitzvahs, and to live a lifestyle which is contrary to the value of the Torah, to say that doesn't require tshuva, that would uproot the whole idea of tshuva. Of course, that's what the Rambam says, is that if a person is involved in the kifas hamon, he's consumed money, because he's consumed by the idea that this is the ultimate good, the fantasy life, the life of the spirit, the self-indulgence, or the recognition of people and ego, that entire way of life is built upon premises that are totally contrary to the whole philosophy, the whole stuff of narratives. Of course he has to be killed. The question being raised, the Rambam seems to have mentioned certain cases, deviations from the gold mean, so to speak. But these types of deviations are on the side of excess. Those deviations where a person pursues the titus, lust, and honor, and cover. And the question being raised, what about a different type of a deviation, which is to the side of their self-denial. Or let's say the person instead, contrary to selfishness, to accumulating money for himself, gives more possession than he's supposed to give, gives away a lot of his money to the extent where it would be incorrect. Because even in terms of giving tzedakah, there's a limit. And a person's not supposed to jeopardize his own hanasim because of a certain emotion that overtakes him to the gift. Things of that sort, so the question is being raised whether that too would be seen under this heading of achievement that the Rambam is talking about. Okay, Rambam in Hilchos Deos, third Shlishi, I think he addresses this issue. That is to say, his sinfulness only with regard to indulgence, a pursuit of one's lust and the powerful desire. The Adoniram says, lest you say, that since Kina and Taiva, see, he's talking about all these things. These are the same things that he mentioned in Parashat Shvi of Tshuva. Vakalod and honor, the Chayotivan, Derech Rohim, that the pursuit of these things is a evil path. You might see in Esther Adam in the Olam, and they take a person out of the world, so to speak, but he's a very destructive in terms of his life in this world. Ethnosh Behem Biyosef, so we'll let a person fail, go to the other extreme. That's Rachel, but Saga Akron, although go all the way to the other side. It is with regard to all of these different activities, a person might say, okay, so I see, I recognize these things are evil, so what's the smartest thing to do? To separate myself from the greatest extent. Actually, Yochal Basav Lo Yishayat. So that he won't eat the meat or drink wine. The ascetic type of effect. That is very popular, by the way, among religious circles. What I'm talking about is a big temptation, a religious temptation, basically. Well, you say, Isha, you won't get married. Well, you say, if you don't know. And you won't dwell in a nice home, in a nice house. All of the different pleasures, physical pleasures, or the pleasures of sleeping. And even the aesthetic pleasures of living in a nice environment. Well, you'll buy a small bishnar. You won't wear nice clothing, comfortable clothing. El ha-saki, atem ha-kosha. The chayote then. That is to say, all these areas will sort of take a look at that. So they didn't partake of these pleasures at all. To John, kohanei ha-ed-de-ho-za. This is like the, you see, the priests of the idol worship. And it's not necessarily the primitive ones. Even the contemporary monks, that's a very, very strong philosophy to this day. And most of the religious sects, they look up to the person, they consider that the highest level, where a person does not partake of the pleasures of this world. To the extent that a person separates himself from the pleasures of this world, then the individual looks up to that. All of this is rooted in a very false idea. And that is to say, the idea being that there is something inherently evil about the physical pleasure that God gave us the capacity to enjoy. Because that's not what I meant. And there's no perfection. The Rambam speaks very harshly against this. Gamzu derech ro'ahi. This too is an evil way. And it doesn't say that, that this is a less evil than the other way, that's an evil way and this is an evil way. Because a person can't relate to that example by pursuing any particular emotional disposition. Everything has to be done with faith, with knowledge, with understanding. You also lay with that. It's prohibited to go in this path. This path that so to speak is sentencing, deprivation. Hamahalech Tagarav Zu, someone who walks in the path, Nikra Chote, which is called a sinner. Shaharei Omer ben Nazir, as it says by a Nazir, and the first Nubia Lysa, the source from the Torah, that this concept of an ascetic existence of deprivation, of living a life in which a person is restrained from attaining the basic benefits, the basic physical pleasures that every individual needs in order to sustain himself in a manner in which he can be psychologically healthy. Physically healthy and psychologically healthy, if a person lives that way, you see that he's a chote because it says by nazir. The chiter alav me'asher chata alana. So he has to be a karban after he's completed the period of time that he's a nazir, and it should atone for him in that he sinned against his soul. Alu zechanim. Chacham said, Umayim Nazir, Tulo Kirash, Elamayayim, Sarasapara, and then I was trying to figure out what he knew wrong over here. He made it there, he kept it there, but he fulfilled his obligation, so where's the sin? So the Chacham said that if the Nazir will only separate from wine, Sarasapara, requires a Kapara, Hamonea atzmo mikol dava v'dava, one who refrains from all forms of particular pleasures and anything, al achas kama v'dava, hamis morso. So that's a chayte. He speaks very strongly against it. The picha tzivu hakalem, therefore the Chacham commanded, shlo yimna adam atzmo el mizbarim, sheminato, atzor of a what? That a person should only refrain from those things that the Torah commanded him to refrain from. In other words, if the Torah is a perfectly calibrated system geared towards the basic structure and soul of the individual. But you see how significant it is. This is a deviation from the path of serving God. Well, after the drop of being served God, you have to accept the fact that God's moving should exist in a certain type of form that will bustle the dog. A person that is negating that element of man, negating the physical, essentially saying something evil about the physical. That's the philosophy of Christianity, that the man is evil by nature. And therefore, they look upon any physical indulgence as being inherently evil. And that's how they look at it, in fact, it can't be favored with a difference. But that's the prevailing attitude. It says if that's the case, so then how can you engage? Oh, well, maybe because of the sake of appropriation, whatever kind of, contortion, broader contortion they want to have. But, to the contrary, this is part of the service of the level. That's the realm of the others. The greatness of the others is that the whole of the Rachach of the ages, in every area of life, person, is relating to every area that God established, is essential to human existence. And if a person approaches that area from the standpoint of what the ultimate purpose is, in terms of making a living, in terms of raising a family, in terms of taking care of his possessions, if everything is done because a person recognizes how it's interconnected, how it's related to his ability to do the service of God, then everything is a service of God. But a person is sleeping. If he works out his day, his existence, in a manner that he puts aside the correct amount of time that he needs in order to punish himself or express himself. So even when he's sleeping, that's considered to be a lot of time. And that's the last of the drama. And that's, of course, not everybody can reach us at the technology level. We're human beings, and most of us can't reach that degree of precision. But that's been showing us the others, that's the ideal. So, getting back to what we said over here, below the hay, Oser Atmo Gandara. We should not create prohibitions for himself through Nagara, through the Shuah, and Oaks. Al-Dubam Amitar, things that are permitted. Kacham of the Kharam. Thus said the Kharam, Loda Yacha, Masha Asa Torah. Is it not enough for you? That was what the Torah prohibited? Ewa Shahata Oser Alacha Dvaram Acherim. But you want to. You want to make more prohibitions. In a sense, this statement of the Chazal, directly, is inherently criticizing this type of behavior, but the sense behind it also, that the person that takes this approach, also, in a sense, the sin is that he's kind of questioning the reason of God, because this reason is so. As I was saying, it's not enough what the Torah is. The Torah is not very dark. So when a person deviates from the Torah, Even in the sense of taking upon himself additional restrictions, which the Torah does not, in a sense, implicit in that is the idea that he knows better. That he's going to improve, so to speak, upon the Torah. In a sense, it violates most, that you shouldn't add. You shouldn't add to the Torah, and you shouldn't diminish from the Torah. Since it's a denial that the Torah is the perfect system. A person should always strive to rearrange, to adjust his own behaviors in accordance with what God has dictated. But this meant a strange mentality, a mentality which is, you obviously see, it arises from an idolatrous approach. If that mentality sees the person, and he begins to live his life that way, in terms of going to the extremes of denial, it's a negation of self. Well, the Chalal Hazeh, included in this category, Elohim is anantamic. People who fast continuously. Ain't on the Derech Tova. It's not the correct, it's not a good care. The Asher Chacham Yishei Adam Masagim Atzmo B'Tainus. And the Chacham prohibited that a person should afflict himself with fast. The Alkalas Marma Elo, the Chayote Man, and regarding all of these things and the like, Tiva Shlomo Viyama, Shlomo commanded, he said, Alki Tzadikarbe, don't be too much of a tzadik. The Alki Tzchakam Yosef, don't be too much of a chacham. Shlomo Tishomo, why should you become desolate? Interesting. Now, so the answer then, getting back to the Rambam and Nefesh Shuvah, the third volume, the question has been raised, these types of deviations fall under the heading of the requirement of the Shuvah, not only for Averos, but also for the sin, so to speak, in terms of faulty dispositions, that a person's emotional dispositions are not in line with the path of moderation. So what about deviations to the extreme of depriving himself, which is there, he's there, after Tshuva, he's there. The Rambam didn't mention that third sign of Tshuva, because he was introducing the category. And that also makes sense to say that by and large, the people he's addressing, well, by and large, the sins tend to be the sins of excess. Most people in the world do not pursue the path of the Tshuva. Most people in the world pursue the path of honoring, wealth and so forth. But I agree with what Matt said before. In terms of logic, it would make sense that any deviation, but as you go back to Deos, the Rambam says specifically that this is a sin. He's a focus on the nothing after Jonah. Okay, trying to see if we can figure out which of these two would be worse. Let's see whether we can figure out which of these two flaws. Two excesses. The excessive indulgence. The person who perceives the material good, as opposed to the person who goes in the other direction. He announces, he lives as a monk or an ascetic. Both of them are an evil path. Both of them are wrong. But which one is worse? Is there any way we can work out which of these two is worse?
We're talking about, the idea of doing tshuva for something which is an onus. And we said that the Rambam mentioned mezid and shogeg, thereby leaving the implication that anything which was not shogeg would not require tshuva. Thus an onus would not require tshuva, according to that. However, we proceeded to analyze it, and we said that there are different types of onus. There's an accident where the person is merely related in terms of being an object. There's no defect. There's no failing. There's no mistake on his part at all. However, there is a different type of an onus in which the person did make some type of a error, even though it doesn't rise to the level of shogeg, as in the case where a person on Shabbos may be in the habit of doing certain things, and in the course of being involved in something, with that thought, may have plucked a leaf or something like that, because that's his nature. That's a habit that he's developed. So there you can't say that he's completely, so to speak, innocent, that there's no defect in him which is related to the commission of the malacha. There is a defect in the individual. And the obligation of the mitzvahs would demand that the person should introspect, should work on himself, and try and anticipate all these things. Part of the observance of Shabbos is certainly the element of anticipation, that a person shouldn't just leave things till in a situation which is prone to disaster, so to speak. That's a state of negligence. So here you have a phenomenon of onus. That is to say, when the actual event occurred, it occurred in the frame of an onus, but it results from the fact that there was a state of negligence. And a state of negligence is something that the person is culpable for. So it's an indirect type of a phenomenon. There I would say that a person has to do tshuva. He has to work on his personality. Of course, the question then arises, is tshuva only for a specific averos, where there's it reaches the level where the person commits a violation? There's an avera, whether it be a losase or an ase, then there's a person obligated to go beyond that. Let's assume that there was no formalized avera. But there's a state of the individual, a state of avera, so to speak, a state of defect, where the person is aware that he has certain defects within himself. That's what the question would lead to. Whether or not one has to do tshuva for this type of an onus leads us to the question of whether tshuva is related only to the phenomenon of avera, where there's a bitl of a mitzvah. What about where there's no avera over here, but the situation reveals that there's a defect with regard to the person's attitude towards the mitzvahs. So that, therefore we went to Perek Zayin. In Perek Zayin, the Rambam says specifically that tshuva is not only for actions, but it's also for bad character traits, dispositions, and so forth. And he lists a few specifically, and it's interesting when he lists them, the ones that he chooses are things, as we mentioned yesterday, that on the surface don't appear to the average individual to be sinful. To the contrary, here you see another significant thing, the tremendous gap between the ideas, the ideals of Torah, and those of the society in which you live. Ram lists as one of the defects someone who's redifas hamamon, who's chasing after mamon. And we mentioned that he's not talking about someone that's doing it illegally, because that's a different avera. So this could be someone who's an extremely successful individual, but his whole drive in life is to amass a fortune, more and more money. So this is someone that would be the ideal person, the ego ideal of the contemporary society that you live in. That's the whole pressure on it. Everybody feels that. That's an important idea, that we definitely assimilate the values of the society, not just directly, but also indirectly. You don't experience it perhaps yourself at this point in time, but you do experience it through your whole upbringing, through your parents are affected by it. So there's a certain drive, there's a certain pressure on a person to succeed. Deep down, there's that feeling that everybody has a desire to get the approval of their peers, of their parents, the people they look up to, the society. And there's a certain feeling that if a person is not successful, so to speak, doesn't make a lot of money, even though the person is involved in Torah, in the areas that are important, but that's something that's difficult because you don't obtain the approval. You don't obtain the approval of your parents or your family, community, and so on and so forth. And these are people, not necessarily people that don't keep Torah. These can be very observant individuals, very observant Jews, but they can vibe, so to speak. It's a very powerful feeling. Very powerful feeling that ultimately really making it has to do with what the society calls success. Acquisition. Materialism. That's a very big draw. And it's something which is very hard to free yourself from. That's why the Rambam says specifically that these, to do tshuva from these, averos, I guess, they're not really averos, they're just dispositions. You can't call it an avera because it's nobody's fault that he has a desire to be a rodef mamon. Although the Rambam is not talking about the one who has the desire over there. He's talking about the one that's actually engaged in it. But even there, it's not that a person decided to be sinful. Most people don't view it as sinful. It's just a natural result of there's an inner disposition towards that, and then it's reinforced by the society. So the Rambam says, the elu ha'avonos, he does call them sins, because it's sinful. Whatever the cause, whatever the intention of the person, the behavior is sinful, because that's the essence of sin, to be involved in that which is not the true good for Adam. That's what evil is. So you have a formalized structure of particular mitzvos or averos. That's one thing. But they don't encompass every activity in the universe. The idea behind it, the idea behind every mitzvah is that it reflects a certain ideal. And the ideal is that which is true for Adam. That's what Adam was designed for. That's the real good for Adam. And avon, sin, is where the person is directed away from the good and towards that which is not the good. It's just an illusion. It's a fantasy. So to the extent that his energies are involved in fantasy, so he's not involved in truth, he's not involved in reality, so that's the destruction of the soul. That's of him.
But
the Rambam over here doesn't say averos. He uses the term avonos, which is different. We have that in the Haftarah that we read, Dirshu, on a Tainus. Yazov Rosh Darko. He refers to the Derech. That the Rosh should abandon his path. Vish Oven, and the man of evil, I suppose, Machshavos of his thoughts. Interesting that Machshavos are associated with Yeshavam. Yeah, because here it's the evil that stems from the fact that the person is directed towards that which is evil towards the individual in the sense of the fulfillment of the purpose of the human soul. And it's very serious, as opposed to an avera. An avera is within the framework of the system, a specific formulation, specific activities that have been delineated. That's an avera. It's a violation. There you're talking about a violation of a law. Here you're not talking about a violation of a law. Here you're talking about the whole character of the personality, what he's absorbed in, how he's living his life. It's a lifestyle type of a phenomenon. This is a lifestyle. For example, he talks about redifas hamacholim, chasing after a food. Let's understand that. Well, what does that mean? What kind of a person are we talking about? What do we mean, chasing after food? Who chases after food? In our society, you don't have to chase after food. It pretty much chases after you. It's all out there and everything is available. You take a leisurely stroll, take a drive to any supermarket, you can get anything you want. What is he talking about? Someone who's chasing. See, the analogy makes sense with regard to money, because that's a chase. That's something you have to really chase after. And that's why he says the redifa, because the redifa really is a reflection of the extent of the involvement, that there's something which is so important to you that in spite of all the obstacles, you chase after it. The drive of the entrepreneur. The term rode, chasing after it, is appropriate. Because when people deviate from the true good, and they become involved in the world of the instinctual, so there's different forms, within that framework, there's different things that attract people, different psychological makeups. There are those that pursue money. Money is the universal. Money, there are those who pursue cover, egotism, so on, that's a pursuit. And there's just so much that a person can put his energy into. That's what it really means. You put your energy, the drive. Rodeth means that the drive, there's a certain drive which predominates the person. So then there's certain particularities. Not everybody is chasing after honor. There's hedonists. There's a whole industry of people that are involved in chasing after the sensual, the sexual. The way the personality sets itself up, it always becomes attracted to certain particulars. So there are people that live their entire lives in pursuit. Their pursuit revolves around everything that has to do with the sensual and the sexual. There are definitely people like that. That it consumes them. And they doesn't mean that they don't have jobs, because you have to sustain yourself. They go to work and do what they have to do. But then in terms of their spare time, when a person has the opportunity to be involved in that which he considers to be truly important, so that becomes their whole thing. It's a whole culture which is built on that type of thing. So then that the Rambam is saying, you have the same phenomenon even by ma'achalos, such is the nature of Adam. Now, so how can a person be a rodef ma'achalos? There's just so much that you can eat. There's just so much that you can eat. All right, so there are people, is he talking about people that are obese, that are overweight? Is that what he's talking about? It means that when a person is involved in something, so it's part of the nature of a person is that it's, even if he's attracted to something which is physical, which is instinctual, in order to become involved in it, there's another part of his personality, which creates a sort of a conflict. There's a conflict because the person has another element, is the element of what we call the superego, is the element of conscience that God implanted in a person. To assist them, because without conscience, people would simply follow their instinctual drives. There'd be nothing to slow them down, nothing to stop them. Of course, conscience can become perverted. That's the ultimate destruction. As long as, because the conscience is not necessarily connected inherently towards that which is good. The conscience also has to be educated by Chachma. That's what we believe. We don't believe in what people say, let conscience be your guide. A lot of people say that. Let conscience be your guide. All evil today. Most of evil. The destruction, 9/11. Today's the anniversary of 9/11. People of conscience, these are very religious people, believe that they were destroying the infidel. That they were doing it for Allah. They were doing it for paradise. It's a matter of conscience. So you see that in order for a person to indulge in any instinctive drive, it's only possible if you bypass the mechanism in the mind that's been established to oppose it and makes it unenjoyable. Because if a person indulges themselves sexually or other instinctual drives, then afterwards you feel a lot of guilt. And then that causes depression and suffering. So then at a certain point in time, a person, it's just not worth it. You may have a few minutes of enjoyment and then you have all the pain. The pain of conscience is one of the worst pains of all. Mental pain is much worse than physical pain. And conscience, everyone who's experienced it, if you feel guilty, and guilt causes depression, and that's one of the most debilitating experiences. So therefore, the person who's driven by the lust for certain physical pleasures, which if they were simply to be followed would evoke the response of the conscience and guilt attacks, what does the person have to do? Have to find some way of bypassing it. And what is the manner that's chosen to bypass the reaction of the conscience? The Pesach Avercha was saying that the idea that we do certain things with regard to shofar. Instead of blowing it at this time, we blow it at the other time, or we don't blow it in the month of Elul, right? Erev Rosh Hashanah, we don't blow it. And the reason that's brought down is la'arvei ves ha-satan, to confuse the satan. And on the surface, it's a very difficult idea to accept at face value. It seems that you're treating the satan as some external force. It sounds like a magical type of a phenomenon. We don't believe in that type of thing. And the essence of tshuva has to do with the person, with internal forces. And the satan is really the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, that which inclines a person. Well, that's the evil inclination. That's ra. And even that is not inherently ra. How can you say it's ra? God implanted it in Adam. It's God's will that you should have all these instincts, and without these instincts, the person couldn't be a person, couldn't function. So what's ra about it? And Chazal say that you should b'chol levavcha, the mishma, that you should love the Lord your God, b'chol levavcha, with all of your heart. So it says with both inclinations, you should serve God with the Yetzer Tov, and you should serve God with the Yetzer Hara, which is very, very important. That tells you something even about the nature of the Yetzer Tov, because it's instructing you to serve God with the Yetzer Tov, with your good inclination. But isn't the good inclination that which actually serves God of itself? If it's good, so it's serving God. What is it telling you? To use it properly. Doesn't that indicate that one can misuse the Yetzer Tov? Oh, so that's the point that I'm trying to make. Because the Yetzer HaTov is the inclination of conscience. It's conscience. It impels it to Yetzer. It inclines. It inclines you in a certain direction. Away from the material. Away from the instinctual. That's the source of what we discussed yesterday. That there is a certain ascetic drive in Adam. That ascetic drive stems from the Yetzer HaTov, so to speak, in conscience. Because people associate a certain type of a guilt. Since guilt is associated with the instinctual, and people don't go beyond the simplistic idea that if I feel guilty, so therefore it must be evil. They just decide. They label things as being good or evil simply on the basis of how they feel, because that's how all of society has been trained. That let conscience be a guide. So what that's essentially saying, so determine the truth of objective reality in terms of how you feel. That's basically what they're saying. So you see from that statement that it's not a simplistic thing, that the so-called Yetzer Hara can be the means of getting closer to Hashem, to serve God with the Yetzer Hara. So therefore the Yetzer Hara cannot inherently be evil. If it's inherently evil, as the Goyim believed, So then how can you serve God with something which is inherently evil? And how can you, and then in the Yetzer HaTov, what is it telling you? It means that there's different inclinations in Adam which incline a person to it in a certain direction. But a person has the ability to control it. And when a person controls the instinctual forces within him and harnesses them and uses them for their proper purpose, that's the big mitzvah that the Rambam is talking about. And Hilchos Deos, to the contrary, says if a person goes to the extreme and tries to negate the instinctual, which everybody else in the world would say, that's wonderful, he's destroying the Yetzer Hara, that's a chote, he says, that's a sinner. That's a falsification. So the point is that a person can only serve God by living in accordance with his seichel, with intelligence, with knowledge, with truth. Of course, we have the Torah, so God has revealed the basic ideas, but we have to use our intelligence to understand the Torah, to draw the proper conclusions, study the Torah properly. That, I think, is the concept of la'arvev es ha-satan, that a person tends to underestimate the power of the satan and overestimate his own power of will. And he doesn't take chait seriously. He thinks it's not that big a deal. If he makes it, he thinks it's just a question of making up his mind. Time will come. That's why people put tshuva off to the future. Right now they're busy. They have other things to do, but eventually they'll do tshuva. When they do tshuva, it's not going to be a big deal because they overestimate their willpower. But Chazal are pointing out that you have to use seichel when you do tshuva. You have to understand how you function, the functioning of the human mind, because a significant element in doing tshuva is to introspect, to look within yourself, and you have to understand the different forces that are at work if you're going to deal with them. So that, I think, is the idea. It's an analogy to confuse. To confuse means that you're dealing, just like if you went out to war, you have to respect your enemy and you recognize that they're intelligent. So therefore, you're going to try and take measures to try and confuse them, to throw them off. So too, you're treating the Yetzer Hara as though it were an enemy that needs to be confused, the Arvei, that needs to be confused. By doing that, you're showing it the proper respect. But this is not a simplistic type of thing. And you have to understand how it operates, and you have to confound its method of operation. That's the truth. That's an intelligent approach to the idea of tshuva. Let's get back to the point of the Rambam's depiction of the person who's a rodef ma'achalos. You learn a lot just from the fact that he chose that as an example. Just to understand that example, the way we're doing right now, you can learn a lot in terms of how people function. Because we've established that the human being is a creature of conflict. Creature of conflict due to the fact that there are different components to the psyche. There's the instinctual side of the psyche, instinctual drive. Then there is the counter drive, which is also an instinctual drive. It's of a different kind. It's instinctual. It's instinctive. Conscience is instinctive. It's not something which is learned. It comes about automatically. Children don't have it in the first few years, but as they get a little older, 6, 7, 8, whatever, it begins to develop. But it's not because they're taught. You can't teach somebody to have conscience. And then there's the third element, which is the tzelem Elokim, the intelligence, the reasoning capacity of the person. Three different elements in this idea. So the way that the individual resolves the problem when there's a conflict between the instinctual drive and the counterforce of the instinct is to counterforce of the instinct of conscience is to blunt the force of conscience by taking, this is an amazing phenomenon, taking something which is essentially instinctual, emotional, and invoking the elements of an ideal to make it into some type of an ideal. And in the case of the materialistic, for example, it becomes a whole idea, a cultural phenomenon, and it's associated with all types of beauty and artistic. That's materialistic. Even latent sexual pursuits are embellished with this cultural phenomenon. It's like a playboy type of thing and a beauty type of thing. And same thing is true with people who are drawn after the the taiva, the lust of eating. So you see, it becomes a whole thing, a cultural phenomenon. A person is a connoisseur of foods, and you see how they're all their mental energy is directed towards trying to perfect something, which is essentially just the gratification of a basic physical thing. And there's a whole culture, and fine wines, and collections, and different dishes. And that's the pursuit. These people are completely involved in that thing, and find meals and different, and they don't even have to be overweight. It's not necessarily the case. And you see, it's a culture because they look down on people that can't appreciate. They can't appreciate all these. They just need basic kinds of food. They look down upon that thing. So that's why he's giving that example. That's a radifa, that's a pursuit, because a person invests all of his energy, and when he does so, he elevates this thing into the ideal. That's really the key element in the chait, that a person invests all of his energy, and this becomes his ideal. This is what he's living for. As absurd as it may seem, you see, it consumes people's lives. And they form different groups and clubs, and there's magazines around that whole thing. That is to remove the element which would cause the guilt, that basically you're just stuffing your face. Basically, it's nothing more than taiva. Than instinctual gratification. That's what the Rambam is talking. That's the rodeif. The rodeif is the element, not the physical pursuit in terms of chasing after something. It's the pursuit, because it's become something which, you know, you have to pursue. You are French cooking and other kinds of cooking and this type of thing. That's the fact that they're putting all of their energy into this type of thing is the pursuit. And that becomes for them an ideal. Once it becomes an ideal, so then a person is really destroyed by it. Because now we've removed the phenomenon of conscience. As long as conscience is functioning, he's still in a state of conflict. So if he's in a state of conflict, he might think it over and decide that it's absurd, that it's just not worth it. But once you remove the element of conscience by establishing it as an ideal, that's when it becomes dangerous, and that's the history of all the evil movements in the world. That's exactly what Hitler accomplished. He was able to appeal to the basest instincts. That's what the people like. The most sadistic, destructive instincts, hatred, and to cloak it into the form of an ideal, that they were fighting for a tremendous ideal for the salvation of the Aryan race, and so on and so forth. Once that happens, so all that energy is now enabled to direct itself because, to the contrary, it's being reinforced. It's being reinforced by the force of conscience. It now has the stamp of approval of that element of conscience. When that happens, that's it. That's Amalek. There's no way to stop it. It produces the worst atrocities that we have the terrorists today, that Israel is dealing with and America is dealing with. The worst atrocities and a clear conscience. Talking about the Rambam has included in the category of things that require tshuva. The person recognizes within himself that he partakes of a bad disposition, bad character trait. So he's mentioning basic types of things that people are drawn after. As we've mentioned, the pursuit of wealth and pursuit of other materialistic drives, enjoyments, pursuit of food, he's mentioned, and so on. So the question is being raised, what about people who detect within themselves that they partake of certain attitudes that are not fully in line with truth or reason or reality? And sometimes it masquerades itself behind a good cause. If a person becomes a fanatic over something which is ostensibly a good cause, that's a pretty common phenomenon these days. A person becomes an anti-smoker and goes on a crusade and looks down at other people and so on and so forth. And the truth be told, you see, it's in his own mind, he thinks he's doing something righteous. But there's a lot of emotion that propels it, and it may cause him to do things that are prohibited in terms of how he treats other people and other causes that people embrace. It's an interesting phenomenon that many people who pose as idealists about the environment, about animals' rights, and things of the sort, you can see that they take it to a degree of fanaticism and becomes an opportunity to express certain very aggressive emotions. Of course, they won't admit it because they've camouflaged it behind their idealism. This type of thing, yeah, requires tshuva. I would agree, it's a distortion. I don't know if the Rambam is talking specifically about this, but he is talking about Deos Ros. I would say that I don't know that the Rambam would include any. No one is perfect, and everybody has certain distortions and, as they say, so-called mishigasim. A person who's living in line with the truth, that's a key element. That someone who's a maskio, doresh es elokim. First and foremost, a person has to have a certain recognition and a certain love of the truth. That's vital in terms of any kind of improvement. And there's two aspects to the truth. There's the objective reality. That's a very important thing. In tshuva, you see, this is the pattern of the Yamim Noraim. Rosh Hashanah is the first of the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days of tshuva, of repentance. And yet we don't do tshuva on Rosh Hashanah. There's nothing in the tefillos that pertain to the tshuva. There's nothing in the tefillos that pertain to anything personal. I don't know how many people are aware of it. The assumption is that this is the time when you're coming before God and you're asking for all your personal things. That's why, one of the reasons why it's a big draw. I think if many people were to actually study the tefillos and understand what they're saying, they might be surprised. They might be disappointed. Whereas all they're praying for is things that pertain to God. Maloch al-kala olam, kula b'chodecha, that the God's kingship, and God's kingship should be recognized. And God's judgment, mishpat. And the tefillah of Shofros, God's revelation. These are things that I don't think people occupy themselves with at all. Certainly religious people have very little concern for these types of things. Where's the personal? Well, people, the sign of Tokev gets them going. That evokes a lot of emotion. Because then it talks about who will live and who will die, who will become wealthy, who will become poor. Things of that sort. That's what gets people going. But that's not even in the Shmona Esrei, the silent Shmona Esrei. That's something which is added, and it's said in the Chazar HaShatz. And the truth is, if you were to omit it, you'd still fulfill your obligation. It's not something which is inherently obligatory. It's a piyut. But that has become the central focus. That's basically what people come to shul for, that type of thing. But the real idea is that the path of tshuva has to begin with an acknowledgement of the ultimate truth, of the ultimate reality. If a person doesn't come to terms with that, so what do you need the tshuva for? If you don't recognize God, and you don't recognize revelation, you don't recognize Torah, that there is an objective reality and a truth, so why change? Just continue following what you're doing. What's the point? And who are you going to return to? The whole idea of tshuva is not self-correction, so to speak. It's to return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to return to God. So first on Rosh Hashanah, the truth of the matter is that the person is not even thinking about himself. He's not even focusing on himself at this point in time. He's supposed to be completely overwhelmed, overcome by the awe at the reality, the recognition of the Borei Olam, of the Creator. And those are the themes that we owe our existence. What's the character of our existence? Where does it come from? Well, what's the source of our existence? And the purpose. There's an element of mishpat, and God created us for a purpose. And that's the only basis for our existence, is to be fulfilling that purpose. And then you have shofros, you have the idea of Torah, of God's revelation, which is the Chesed, the Hashem, that guides us towards the fulfillment of our purpose. Once a person is clear in terms of the foundations, the yesodos that pertain, then the next step is the subject. There are two types of knowledge that a person must have in order to perfect himself, in order to do any kind of tshuva. One is knowledge of objective reality, so to speak, philosophical. That would be like akin to philosophical knowledge. Nothing to do with yourself. Truth about reality. The existence of God. The phenomenon of Torah, of revelation, and so on. The truth. What is the truth? Then, once a person has conviction with regard to the truth pertaining to reality, then where do I stand? If that is the case, now I have to look back on my own life. What kind of life am I living? Does my life have anything to do with the objective purpose, with the real truth, or am I in some kind of a dream world? I'm just following my own whims, my own emotions, and my own way of thinking, which is faulty. Now you have to do tshuva. Once you obtain a recognition of the ultimate truth, then you can do tshuva. That's a different kind of knowledge. That's not so simple either. I tried to explain my understanding of the concept of la'arve v'hasata. The person has to have psychological knowledge, because it's complex. The phenomenon we're discussing now, that people can masquerade their evil intentions in righteous causes, shows you that the Yetzer Hara works in devious kind of ways to trick the person. So you have to have a tremendous amount of honesty, which is, again, that's the foundation, the love of truth. If a person has a love of truth, so then it's going to apply to all areas, even in the most painful areas, even with regard to the self, which is the hardest area to obtain a love of truth. Because there's very powerful, there's another love, there's the love of self. The self-love interferes, blocks it. That's the that's the outline, so to speak, the format of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. After Rosh Hashanah, then we begin the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, then we begin the process of tshuva, of introspection, to see where do we stand in the scheme of things. Plus, in doing tshuva, a person has to have a recognition, and that too has to do with the objective knowledge. What exactly is a chait? You can't use your categories. That's where the Rambam begins, in Kol Mitzvah Satoru. Here too, it's not just following your own emotions, what you feel guilty about. Well, you don't feel guilty about it. That's not the way to go. You have to know in reality what constitutes sin. So there's 10 chapters. The Rambam goes into the different kinds of sins and the more significant ones and then the so-called kalos, the not as serious ones. And then the ones between man and God and the ones between man and Ben Allah Chavera was a different procedure in terms of tshuva. Yeah, you have to know how to do tshuva too. That's knowledge. Everything is knowledge. Everything requires knowledge. So, and we saw that even with regard to mitzvahs, he has to tell you positive commands, negative commands. You just can't follow your own natural inclination in these things of what you consider to be wrong behavior. And even with regard to mezid and shogeg, intentional and error. And then, but he omits the category of ones, if it was, so to speak, accidental. Everything has to be understood. To do tshuva requires understanding. That's an area of wisdom as well. Then in chapter 7, he goes into the issue of things that are not specific averos, because the Torah doesn't legislate. They can't legislate everything that's a distortion. The area of deos, the area of emotional dispositions that a person is supposed to cultivate. So if a person notices within himself that he partakes, it's in a state. That's a state of sin of the gavra, so to speak, as opposed to a particular maisavera. So he has to do tshuva from those things as well. And the Rambam said that's even more complicated, even more difficult to work on than doing tshuva from a specific avera, because this entails the entire personality, as opposed to a certain behavior. It's easier to control a certain behavior that you can delineate, you can earmark, you can control it. If you have the will, that's something that's more susceptible to the power of determination and the will. But your whole way of living, the things you're drawn after and the things you desire and the things that you want, your whole personality, that's much more complicated. So there too, it has a certain frame. He's talking about certain particular things. But of course, if a person is honest, he can look at many, many quirks that a person has, neuroses that a person has, behaviors that a person has, that if you would analyze them, you see that they're based on a certain irrationality. That, I believe, would fall into a different category, unless it reaches the level of something which is major, which is driving the person's life. That's why I'm making the differentiations. When the Rambam has listed things that are major, a person is living his whole life based upon the pursuit of money. That becomes for him the ultimate good. That's very significant. Or the pursuit of physical pleasure. That's hedonism. He's talking about something which constitutes an alien philosophy and drives the person. So that takes him out of the world of Torah. That takes him out of the world, period. But to say that any type of a quirk, any type of an attitude which you can point to and show that there's an irrationality there, for example, let's say a person has a fear of flying. You know, a lot of fellows have come to talk about that, fear of flying. And you analyze it with them. We're flying airplanes. So does a person have to do tshuva for that? I'll pose that question to you. I speak to a lot of guys, you go through it logically. You go through it logically and there's no basis for it. Because what are you afraid of? And how come you're not afraid in a car? A car is more dangerous. I mean, you know, those types of arguments. And it's obvious, it's because what it boils down to is that the person is really stuck in terms of their sense perception, and that the knowledge of the mind, the abstract knowledge that it's safer in fact, can't overcome the sense perception of the fear, that's the feeling that's evoked by the sense perception. In terms of knowledge, a person should be more relaxed. It makes much more sense to fly than to drive. There's much more accidents. And you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of drivers. You don't know if the guy's drunk, if he can drive properly, whatever. Here it's professionals, run by professionals. These guys are pilots, and 99% of the time, what, they're not drunk because they caught the guy drunk. That's true, but you're not worried about it. That's very unusual. And the system immediately clamps down.
We had a guy
who has certain fears or phobias or neuroses. That's not fate. That's an emotional type of a distortion. Should a person work on it? Or shouldn't they work on it? That depends how important it is to the person. If a person has a fear of flying and it's really interfering with their life, it's making things very difficult. So it makes sense. This is not a point of Torah, though. I don't think that this has anything to do with what we're talking about in terms of tshuva. Of course, the more perfected an individual is, the more the person wants to uproot compulsions and obsessive emotions and so on and so forth out of a general recognition that they will impede the person in certain areas. But that's a different kind of thing. That's in the framework of an individual who loves truth. And we were talking about before that people have certain attitudes. A person might have certain negative attitudes because they're crusading for a certain cause. That in and of itself is not what the Rambam is talking about over here. Unless that's become his consuming passion. The person's consuming passion has become something which is contrary to Torah. Like Redifas HaMamo. So that would be like Redifas HaKavod. That might fall into that type of category. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about someone who is more of a pastime, so to speak. It's an occasional kind of thing. That, if a person loves the truth, when somebody points out to them that it's not what they think it is, but it's more of some type of a compulsion, it's a compulsive behavior, so the person who loves truth will want to uproot those types of things in all areas. That's the hallmark of a perfected individual. The hallmark of a perfected individual is moda ala emes. If the person loves truth, and even in seemingly small areas, will acknowledge the truth. If somebody points out that the position he's taking in a certain area, which he thinks is so logical, really is flawed, and it's based upon certain emotions, which he doesn't want to acknowledge. So a chacham will listen to that criticism. Will listen and will take it to heart, and will analyze it, and will acknowledge it, because of the person's love for the truth. But I don't think that that's what the Rambam is talking about over here. Here the Rambam is talking about an obligation to do tshuva. An obligation to do tshuva, again, is dealing with something which is an objective reality. It's the deos rovs that the person partakes of. That is serious. That's not just a question of how perfect you are. That's an obligation to work on it and to change. So that your amigo should be in line with the truth, with the Torah. Back now to the question we left off with. That is to say that the Rambam in Deos has delineated two different types of dispositions which are sinful. He came out very strongly against people that go to the other extreme of deprivation, not just the extreme of indulgence. And those people that prohibit, abstain from things that the Torah permitted and believe it's a virtue to go to the extreme of self-denial, he said that's like the Kohani Avodah Zarah, that's like idolatry, and it's the sinner, and you see that the Nazir has to bring the Chote, the Torah calls him a Chote, and it would seem that there's really no difference. So the question we left with is, A, if a person does partake of those types of deos, is that included in Perek Zayin of Tshuva? The person has to do Tshuva just as much as he has to do Tshuva for the ones the Rambam mentioned. And the question was, why didn't the Rambam include that category? Why only the category of people who suffer from overindulgence? Now the question that we raised was, of the two, which one is worse? To suffer from an extreme of indulgence or to suffer from the other extreme of denial? That's not an easy question to answer, but the Rambam does in the Shemona Prakim, in the fourth chapter, makes a very significant point. That is, from a practical standpoint, it is easier to go from a position of denial back to the Shvil HaZav, to the golden means, as opposed to correcting yourself from the extreme of indulgence back to the one of the Shvil HaZav is much more complicated, is more difficult. So it would seem, you can explain that in different ways. That when the person gives in to the extreme of indulgence is really in line with the natural inclination of the person. The person is in an emotionally healthy state, so he naturally desires these things. And then when he gets into those desires, it can get out of hand. That's the nature of the person. The instinctual makeup of the person is drawn after certain things. So to go back to correct yourself from the extreme of indulgence is really a much more difficult battle, because you're really denying the emotions. You're denying the instincts. It's a painful kind of a thing. That's why I think the Rama mentioned that when a person is submerged in these things, it's very difficult to get out of it. That's the point that he made. And it could be for that reason that the Rambam chose those examples. Because when he was talking about this type of sin, this type of avera that a person partakes of, he wanted to make the point that a person shouldn't look down on these as not being that significant and just averos. And he was saying, because these things are very difficult to remove oneself from. That would be more true of the overindulgence. However, the other extreme of denial is sin. It's a sinful phenomenon. But the Rambam says it's easier if a person has gone to the extreme of self-denial in terms of clothing, in terms of basic needs. Once that is removed, once the person recognizes that it's wrong, it's much easier to go back towards moderation, because that's in line with the basic instinctual makeup of the person. Now, whether it's also true, not just from the practical, but from the intrinsic standpoint, that is to say, even if a person doesn't go back, that and we have to evaluate in terms of the damage itself, it's possible to say that if a person takes on additional limitations, restrictions, fasting, people that afflict themselves with fasts, as opposed to those who are constantly involved in indulgence, it is possible to make the point that even if you can measure one against the other, in terms of the corruption per se, that I'm not entirely convinced that it's true, but my basic thought is that the indulgence is worse. Because the person who's completely involved in indulgence, the mind is is totally destroyed in terms of any type of truth. Well, while a person who refrains from the pleasure, so that person, I mean, unless they're filled with crazy ideas, that's something else. But generally speaking, that person tends to be someone who's using their mind more. The energy has to go somewhere. So that is simply a problem because they're not in the appropriate state. And also they're making a mistake and they're regarding the physical indulgences as a mistake. They're regarding those things as inherently evil. But the state of the person is one in which the person can still function. You can still use your mind because you're not subsumed by the love of the material and subsumed in lust. For example, you can see the, in terms of the Dor HaMabul, they had to be destroyed. The Dor HaMabul had to be destroyed because they were completely overcome by the sensual. When a person is completely overcome by the sensual, then they're living a life of a behemoth. It's an animalistic life. Whereas where a person goes to the other extreme of denial, it's not an animalistic life. It's a life of control. The person has submerged the instinctual. Unfortunately, it's gone to an extreme and it's a distortion and it's wrong. But it doesn't, in my opinion, have the same devastating effect upon the psyche that the other part has, because the other part, when a person's living that way, they're living just like a behemoth. So it could be that the Rambam chose to cite those examples, which are kasha, the ones that really have that element of being extremely difficult to part from. But I would say that if you ask the question, if a person recognizes within himself that he partakes of a nazir type of mentality, that the Rambam says is sinful. Yeah, this is, from Dale's itself, he says that's chote. He definitely has to chew with him. Definitely it's included. That I would say is included in the Deos Ros that the Rambam talks about in Perek Zayin. But the Rambam didn't list all of them. What's the matter?
I'm just saying that it's still an answer. The fact that it doesn't.
Well, yeah, why not?
Well, I mean, it's like saying that one of the indulgent personality is more severe. You know, that's...
Now, continuing what we discussed yesterday, that the Rambam in Perek Gimel and Perek Dalet talks about different characteristics that certain averas have from the standpoint of tshuva. It's very important that not all averas are equal with regard to the complexities, the problems that they create in terms of a person doing tshuva. And it's important to realize that, to understand that a person wants to stay away. As I mentioned, I gave numerous examples yesterday. That a person doesn't want to put themselves in a situation of danger with things that are important. And even when a person does, for whatever reason, the wrong thing, or takes risks, or chances, you're always calculating. Even if it should go wrong, but I'll be able to work my way out of it somehow or other. But I make it clear that if you do this kind of a thing, there's no way out, there's no excuses, and then you're going to treat that differently. I just want to mention, though, that at the end of Perek Dalet, in Halacha Vav, of Perek Dalet, where he's gone through the 24 averos, where they're very severe in terms of creating barriers to tshuva, he concludes by saying, "Kol elu hadvarim uchiyote ben," all of these things, and those which are similar, "afal pishem ha'akvin es ha'tshuva," even though they withhold the tshuva, they create barriers to tshuva, "ein monin osa," they don't prevent it. So that's interesting. It's some ways in between. It creates greater difficulties and barriers in terms of doing tshuva, but he doesn't mean to say that that's it, that it makes it impossible. It does not render tshuva impossible. "Ela im asa adam tshuva," but if a person did tshuva, mehen, from them, hareza baal tshuva, the person's baal tshuva, v'yesh lo chelek olam haba, and he has a chelek olam haba. That's important to remember. I wouldn't utilize this to lessen the severity. A person has to be a chacham. That is to say that there's great severity over here, and that these averos create greater barriers towards doing tshuva. there are certain types of temptations you give into. Once you give into them, it's very hard to get out of them. Well, drugs. One of the best arguments against it, forget about all the other arguments. There's many arguments against it. But a person may be attracted to try different things. A person may be attracted to try a wine or to get high and on a certain type of an alcohol or beer or beverage, whatever. And you could argue against it, why it's not a good thing to do at a party and all of that. You'll make a fool out of yourself and so on. And you can use all these arguments. Sometimes they'll work. Sometimes they won't work. However, if it's a choice between that or a drug experience, I think you'll have an additional argument in the case of the drug experience. What would the argument be? The addiction. There's an addictive quality that the drug has that, let's assume, the alcohol doesn't have. That's something to think about. That is, can I indulge? Because the person's going to think, going to take everything into consideration. Can I indulge in this type of an experience, even though we agree it's the wrong thing to do? So we're not. But nevertheless, people, sometimes they're in different kinds of moods. And whatever the factors are, I just want to have a good time tonight, and I'm casting aside all the inhibitions, and I just want to go out there and drink and have fun and dance, and if I make a fool out of myself, I'll make a fool out of myself. But if you tell the person, okay, so do that. All right, I can't stop them. I've argued with you all night long. I've showed you why it's your choice. You're willing to do it, do it. But if it's an issue of a drug, and I tell you that it's not just a matter of tonight, because in your mind, it's just tonight. My life can absorb one night of craziness, then I'll go back to my studies, whatever, and I'll be a good citizen for a while. That's how a person thinks. I'm sure that's how a person thinks. But then if I tell you there's a possibility of permanent damage or smoking something, not a drug, just smoking something, there's a possibility of permanent damage, and you think about that. You don't want permanent. What you really want is the opportunity to have your fun and get out. And no harm done. Everybody goes home innocent, so to speak. Nobody gets hurt. That's what you want. But if I tell you that it's addictive, and you're going to face a problem, and then there's going to be a possible withdrawal, or you won't have withdrawal, you'll be stuck on the thing, and you become a drug addict, that's something that you're going to think about. That's not what you want. You don't want that. You want to get out of it. So that's a very good illustration, then, of the significance of understanding that with these averos, you are taking a very, very big risk that it may become part of your personality, and you may not be able to escape from it, and you may be doomed. It's an addiction. It's a spiritual type of a negative addiction. It's important to remember both things. It's important to remember that these types of averos are very, very dangerous in terms of preventing the path, blocking off the pathways of tshuva. At the same time, the Rambam must tell you that you shouldn't think that there is no tshuva for these averos. That is to say, that a person can do tshuva from these averos, and if the person does do tshuva, then the averos are forgiven, and he has a chelik in Olam Haba. That's essential to know as well. That should not lessen the manner in which you consider it, the danger involved. The person that's intelligent doesn't want to fool around with things that are that dangerous. You don't want to jump into quicksand, because it's very difficult to get out of it. I'm not saying it's impossible. You might have a rope, you might be able to lasso it, or somebody might pass by, you might be able to pull yourself out of it. Yeah, people have escaped from it, but only a fool would go into it with the assumption that he'll be able to get out of it. So your assumption should be that you won't be able to get out of it. However, for those who are already in it, they should not be in despair that there's no way out. There's just no tshuva, but that's not true. Now we're talking specifically about the idea of making fun out of other people. The specific question is, we all know that it's wrong, but are there situations in which it's acceptable in harmless kinds of situations amongst friends? When friends kid around with each other, and I'll use the expression as ranking each other out. The question's been raised as to whether there's a harmless form. Among friends, it seems to be, from a common practice standpoint, something which most people indulge in, the question that is whether that's considered an avera, though. Is it permitted? And if so, what are the parameters? In Perek Gimel of Tshuva, Halacha Yadalim, the Rambam concludes his listing of 24 very serious averos. And he's just mentioned major averos entailing things like kfira, denial of Hashem, denial of Torah, Shabbat, things of that sort. And he says that each one of these 24, whoever does them, and does them of course means without the tshuva, does not have a share in the world to come. Then he says, "V'yesh averos kalos me'elu." There are sins that are not as severe, less severe, lighter, so to speak, than these. V'yaf al pikein, nevertheless, amru chachamim, the chacham said, "Sharogel behen," that one who is familiar with them, that is to say, rugel means that this becomes a pattern.
Or custom.
It's habitual, it's customary, and so forth. Rugel. It doesn't mean to say that a person did something just once in their life. When we talk about lashon hara, the expression is a baal lashon hara, someone who's, that's part of their nature, someone who's a gossip, who engages in it on a pretty regular basis. Person, and not that occasionally, once in 20 years, a person said something and realized it was lashon hara. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about rugel, then. Ram over here is talking about regilus, that this becomes habitual. So he says that a person who is rugel in these things does not have a share in the world to come. Then he says, uchedaihein lehesracheik mehen, and it is fitting to distance yourself from them, ulehizoher behen, and to be extremely careful. That's very, very important what the Rambam said. The person, it's not enough just to avoid them, but you have to assume a certain attitude towards them. Again, I use the analogy of disease. If a person knows that something is really seriously harmful, it's not just that he doesn't partake of it, he stays far, far away from them. They is very careful with regard to these things. The Eluhain, and they are Hamachana Shem L'Chavero, one who devises, so to speak, coins a name for his friend. I'll give an illustration of making up a name, which is, of course, to poke fun at the person. That's clearly what he's talking about. He's not talking about a case. There is such a thing as nicknames. In Hebrew, you have that. And you have nicknames in English, you probably have nicknames in any language. The phenomenon itself is not bad. To the contrary, very often it's because of affection. That you, usually it's a shortening of the name, or it's somehow connected to the name, but for whatever reason, I'm not going into the whole psychology over here, it's something pleasant, it's something that people like. To the contrary, very often when you're angry at someone, you mention their full name, you stop using the nickname, which is more in terms of affection. So that's not what the Rambam means. The Rambam means when it's being done to poke fun. Let me give you an example. There used to be a senator from the South named Fulbright, William Fulbright. Whatever his views were, I think he was very liberal, and I think he was very against the war in Vietnam, whatever the case is. So his critics, who disagreed with his policies about defense, I guess today he'd be considered very left-leaning, would call him Senator Halfbright. They referred to him as Senator Halfbright. So it's funny. It's a play on the name. But it's clearly an attempt to cast the aspersions, to make him look like a fool. The Rambam over here is not just talking about making fun out of people. There's something specific which has to do with the name of a person, which is hurtful, which is more effective. The question is, what is so specific? The Rambam over here is saying that one who's mechana, that one who gives the person a nickname, va'korei lechavero b'kinuyav, and someone who calls his friend through these kinuyim, these nicknames. I would imagine, of course, that he's talking about painful ones that make the person feel bad. Again, it doesn't make sense to me to say that he's talking about any nickname which the person doesn't object to. He talks about further, one who embarrasses his friend in public. And one who draws a certain amount of honor at the expense of his friend, by comparison. And then he goes on, okay, these other categories. Our objective here is not to go through all the categories. They're all important. However, a number of them relate to this issue of making fun out of somebody else. That's all these things have in common. That the basic objective is to make fun out of somebody else. It's very important to understand. It's a very powerful emotion. And it's significant on many, many levels. It's part of the aggressive instinct. But the reason why, you could say, by the way, in order to have a means of understanding what determines why these averos are hard to separate from, one factor is when a person derives a lot of emotional, instinctual enjoyment from an avera, so it's satisfying different elements of the personality, the more it satisfies, the more intense the experience, and the more the draw. You become addicted to it. People that speak Lashon Hara and gossip, they're like addicted to it. They get together and it starts and they can't stop. It functions pretty much like any other addiction. It satisfies the aggressive instinct, aggression. People have a tremendous amount of aggression. It satisfies the sadistic. It satisfies the ego, the arrogance, the sense of being superior to others. So it's a very difficult area to conquer, but it's very vital. So it's important to remember what the Rambam says to be mizrachek. The reason he says to be mizrachek is because if it's something which is so appealing to a person, then when you're in the proximity, it's going to get you. You're going to get drawn into it. So the only way to deal with it is by staying far away from it, and not relying on your own power of self-control. You're going to lose. The desire is too strong. You have to understand that with regard to certain averos, you don't just rely on your element of self-control. You don't put yourself in compromising situations and say, but I'll be able to overcome the taiva. You have to know that this taiva is stronger than you are at any point in your life. If the taiva is stronger than you are, you don't put yourself in proximity. You stay away from the arena. You stay away from the situation. What is significant about the kinui, what differentiates this, is that it's one thing to make fun out of another individual. That's just one episode, and it's serious, it's significant. But the name of a person is very important to that person. People are very sensitive when you make fun out of their names. People are even sensitive if you don't pronounce their names right. You notice that. You only have no fault of your own, like a teacher sometimes with the first day of class is trying to read the names, can't get the names straight. People identify with their names. That's, so to speak, their psychologically, their essence. So even if you forget a person's name, it's very disturbing to them. But what it really means is you're just dismissing them, you're negating them. It's a negation. In the case where you're coining a name which makes fun out of them, to the contrary, you're saying that that's their essence, that they're ridiculous by nature, that's their whole nature. And that is making it permanent, it's giving it a certain type of a permanence. And on that level, it's a trauma for the person. This arena is very, very important in terms of your whole relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's just been mentioned that in addition, people are attracted because it helps them deal with their insecurities. That is true. It hits the person on many, many psychological levels. That's why it's so appealing. People that are insecure about themselves don't want to face up to themselves, so they feel much, much better to be able to point out somebody else's defects. By contrast, they're saying, look at me, I don't have that defect. Also, it has to be borne in mind that on an entirely different level, there's the element of denial of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. that lies behind this whole area of mistreatment of others. Why so? Now, one of the ideas that's being mentioned is very good, and that is to say that it's denial of Tzelem Elokim. So indirectly it's denial of God. That is the basis for respecting other people, v'ahavta l'rech kamocha, is the recognition, ki b'tzelem elokim, asa asa adam. That's in Noach, after the Mabel, where God warns, God gives permission to eat the animals, then God warns the whole world, so to speak, and animals too, not to kill Adam, ki b'tzelem elokim, asa asa adam. That Adam is not just another animal, but Adam has a unique dimension of Tzelem Elokim. Now, this aspect of derogatory treatment, to the extent that you change the name, you're really saying he's just, that's what he's an animal. You're diminishing that person from the level of Tzelem Elokim to the level of animal. And that's why it has to do with the denial of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's one other reason, though, more direct, I would say, in which these type of sins have to do with the denial of God. The whole idea behind Lashon Hara and this whole category of Averos is really a denial of God. And it is rooted in a very powerful feeling that the only thing that matters is human opinion. The idea of destroying other people through laughter, through derision, through opinion, through gossip, through talking about them. And conversely, the reason why it bothers people so much. This is the kind of thing that the enjoyment that a person gets out of it is related to the pain that a person, when they're on the receiving end. And why is it so harmful to a person? It's true that it's harmful to a person, the one who receives the pain. It's also because that person has a certain weakness. It's interesting to note. You can't use it as a defense, but the truth of the matter is, why should you care what other people think of you? Why should you care if other people are laughing at you? Why? What difference does that make? Assuming there's no practical consequences. And it has nothing to do with practical consequences. If somebody is publicly embarrassed, he feels crushed, he feels destroyed, because the whole room laughed at him and thinks the whole room thinks he's a fool. Now the question, of course, arises, what, so what? Are you a fool or aren't you a fool? I'm not a fool. Oh, so then what do you care? So then they must be wrong, and what do you care? First, when analyze it, logically, you'd have to come to the conclusion that there's no basis for it. From a logical standpoint, there's no reason to be concerned about what other people think of you. However, that can never be the justification. You can't make fun out of a person, and then the person complains, and you say, like, what do you care? What do you care what I think? Because the Torah demands that we treat people on the level that they're on. This is considered to be a legitimate emotion. A person's on a perfected level, he's removed himself from that. But that's true. Tzaddikim, they'll love him, v'yenim olzim. That the tzaddikim are insulted, and they don't insult them back, because they're not insulted in reality. Their view of themselves is purely based upon their reality. They live in a different realm. In the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if they have defects, they work on them. However, the underlying idea, which is not necessarily conscious, the implicit element in Lashon Hara is that there's reality to what people think about you. That's the world of reality. The world of reality is social opinion. And if I destroy you socially, you're dead. And if you're, on the contrary, if you're important, if you have a place in the social scene, that's it. You're made. That's a denial of the realm of truth. That's a denial of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're saying that the reality is what people think of you, not what God thinks of you. So you're saying that the human situation is the only thing. That's all we see. Yeah. There are people that actually believe that. It's who you know, so to speak. Well, it's not what you know, it's who you know may have some practice. That's true. On a practical level, you need connections in certain areas. But people relate to that. The social is the most significant thing in their lives. You see, you just observe how people behave, and you see that How many people strive? Their whole life is a tremendous struggle to be able to keep up their social pretenses. And that they could be, it has certain good consequences. So I'm not saying it doesn't, because a lot of times people are even from, keep a from household and so on, and send their kids to yeshiva. And if you really analyze it at the bottom, it's not because it's just powerful convictions, but that's their society. That's in that group. They don't want to be outcasts. So the social emotion in mankind is very, very, very powerful. And you see how people struggle also. Comes time to make a bar mitzvah or a wedding, and you have to keep up at a certain level. Or in terms of your clothing, in terms of other things, the amount of energy, effort, and aggravation to make the kind of money to be able to keep up the social pretense, if you analyze it and work it through with the person, you see it's a social standing. You have to maintain your social standing is a tremendously powerful force. And all right, that itself is not a avodah zarah. It's not in the form of a avodah zarah, but it is rooted in an overestimation, overvaluation of one thing, the opinions of others. Here, it's the social, it's purely abstract. It's not a particular, this particular person or that particular person. It's just the social standing. It's amazing. It's all in your imagination. Because you imagine a certain social reaction. And not only do you imagine it, and you don't know if it could be happening, it could not be happening. Or, for example, I'll give you an example. It's like, used to be, it's not so significant anymore. It used to be that there was a terrible taboo against divorce, especially in the Jewish, especially in the religious community. Of course, with the developments in society today, it's pretty commonplace. It doesn't have that type of a scandalous effect anymore. It doesn't act as a deterrent. A lot of people remain married because they couldn't tolerate it. But when a couple, let's say now, a couple gets divorced, this thing is not as great as it used to be, but even so, there's some kind of a buzz. But the truth of the matter is that, if you think about it, sorry, so this Shabbos, it makes the news. It's the buzz in the shul, whatever. But how long does the buzz last? You think about it, that even if it bothers you, and you don't like the fact that people are talking about you in that way. But you also bear in mind that it doesn't have a long shelf life. It has a short shelf life, because after a while, that's it. So people, once it comes out, people talk about it. And then they need something new to talk about, and yours is old news. But that's, see, when it affects you, you don't look at it that way as old news. It keeps bothering you. It's as though you walk around as though everyone's talking about you all the time, when they're not. Aside from the fact that how important that is altogether, see, people will buy a new car. They won't admit it to themselves, but part of that thing is that when they drive and everybody looks at them, wow, that wow kind of thing. That's an abstract thing. It wears off very quickly. People have so many other things to think about. And the significance, anyways, is very minimal. So first you should factor that in. But I'm just saying that in terms of perfection, the person that this is a significant part of their life, the putting down of others, the involvement in Lashon Hara, and diminishing other people, is also rooted, it's rooted in a denial of Tzelem Elokim, and ultimately it's rooted in a denial of God. Because the person cannot have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. His whole relationship is what people think. The social instinct has taken complete hold over his philosophy of life.